Hello, this is Paula Kaufman with the Herald and Review for Thursday, November 29, 2018. Let's start today's reading with an article on the front page, headlined, Election 2019, Error Ends Mayoral Campaign. Kara Demirjian-Huss Withdraws from Race After Filing Oversight, by Tom Lisi, Decatur. Kara Demirjian-Huss will not be running for mayor of Decatur after getting notice from the city clerk that she failed to file all the necessary paperwork to appear on the ballot. She was one of four candidates who had filed petitions for the April 2019 mayoral election. Others are incumbent Julie Moore Wolf, Councilman David Horn, and Jacob Jenkins, an employee at the Illinois Department of Human Services. This is a very sad and emotional day for me, as I have been absolutely committed to leading our community, Demirjian-Huss said in an emailed statement. I will be immediately sending my supporters their donations back. Demirjian-Huss was the first to file her paperwork and would have been first on the ballot. Candidates for city-elected positions are required by state law to file statements of economic interest with the Macon County Clerk's Office, disclosing information about their employment and business dealings. Demirjian-Huss said she did so, but neglected to provide the city with a receipt from the county showing that she had filed the statement. As a result, she said, the city told her that she would not be certified to appear on the ballot. In the future, I hope that the petition process is better communicated and streamlined, Demirjian-Huss said. She had announced her candidacy in September, citing her business experience as the founder of DCC Marketing and former president of the Economic Development Corporation of Decatur and Macon County. Demirjian-Huss was the first candidate to announce her intention to challenge Moore Wolf. I believe that the leadership in our city government from the mayor's position could definitely be stronger, she said at the time. We need someone who can provide the expertise and leadership and really an inside perspective from a business side. Moore Wolf said in a phone interview Wednesday night that she was shocked at the news and felt bad on a personal level for Demirjian-Huss, with whom she has been friends for years. You feel bad if somebody really wants to run and can't because something doesn't go right, said Moore Wolf, who is executive director of philanthropy, advocacy, and community relations for HSHS St. Mary's Hospital. I feel bad because I know she's put effort into this and really wanted to do this. Moore Wolf has served as mayor since 2015, when she was appointed after the death of former mayor Mike McElroy. She was elected to serve out the remaining mayoral term in 2017, defeating challenger John Phillips 53% to 47%. She is the city's first female mayor. She said the news would not affect her campaign and how she approaches the race. I'm running on my record and what I've been able to bring to this community and what I hope to bring to it, she said. There are two other people that want this job. I also want it very badly, so I'm going to do everything I can to keep this job and continue working for the people of the city. Reached by phone, Jenkins reacted to the news with disappointment. I felt that she was going to be a formidable opponent and really made this race interesting, he said of Demirjian-Huss. She had a bunch of great ideas to push this city forward and in the right direction, and I'm truly sad I won't get an opportunity to debate her. Horn said in a phone interview late Wednesday evening that the news of Demirjian-Huss's withdrawal had to have been a difficult experience for her and her supporters. She would have represented the city well, he said. Three council seats are up in the election. Two incumbents, Lisa Gregory and Bill Faber, will face five challengers, retiree Marty Watkins, accountant Siobhan Francis, Taylorville Correctional Center Warden Sheilith Hansbrough, Skywalker International Sports Complex CEO Rodney Walker, and auto shop owner John Phillips Jr. Councilwoman Dr. Dana Ray opted to step down at the end of her term. The election is April 2nd. The full statement from Demirjian-Huss is below. As of today, I am officially withdrawing from the election. This is a very sad and emotional day for me, as I have been absolutely committed to leading our community. I received notice today from the city clerk that my name has not been certified to be on the ballot for mayor. At 8 a.m. on November 19th, I turned in my petitions to the city clerk for nomination, and then immediately filed into the public records my statement of economic interest with Macon County as required. However, I neglected to then file with the city my receipt from the county for my statement of economic interest. As a result, the city will not certify my petitions. I will be immediately sending my supporters their donations back. In the future, I hope that the petition process is better communicated and streamlined. With that, I will not be in the Christmas parade, nor will I be having the December 3rd fundraiser event. I am grateful for the community's support and wish the other candidates good luck. Contact Tom Lisi at 217-421-6949. Follow him on Twitter at Tommy Lisi. Dolphins to remain beached. With TLC, landmark sculptures may rise again someday. By Donette Beckett. Decatur. For those with a pool of treasured Decatur memories, a pair of concrete dolphins often rise to the surface. The two statues, dubbed Nip and Tuck, were once a fixture of the former Landmark Mall in downtown Decatur, standing 4.5 feet tall in the 300 block of North Water Street. The couple are long gone, but still bring back images of happy childhood memories for many. Decatur resident Sean McElyea, 50, remembers the downtown area full of fun things for kids to look at, the rotating sea on the Citizens Bank building, the water fountains in Central Park, and the escalators in Sears Department Store. Storefronts always seem to have something new. In the middle of all this was the two dolphins, she said. They had the cutest smile. They were smooth where we would pet them, and what kid wouldn't try to sit on them? The dolphins were installed September 28, 1970, according to Herald and Review archives, and were a play structure for children as well as decoration for the mall area. Nip and Tuck were composed of concrete and reinforced by steel, weighing about 1,800 pounds each and measuring 7 feet long. In 1986, they were removed when the city renovated the mall to allow vehicle traffic from North Street to North Park Street. The couple are still in Decatur, but have since retired. Today, they can be found stored in a Nelson Park maintenance shed. Decatur Park District Executive Director Bill Clevenger said the district took possession of the statues. Because the city was just going to get rid of them, he said. They were given to us, hoping we could do something with them. Decades have not been kind to the once-beloved statues. Makeshift repairs were done years ago. It's unclear who performed them, but the work left the statues with an uneven surface. You can tell the difference, Clevenger said. If they were repaired professionally, they would have the same exposed aggregate look. Park District officials told the Herald and Review in 2013 that they hope to incorporate the dolphins into the Nelson Park Lakefront Development Project, which has included new docks and a promenade area in front of the Beach House restaurant. The project was designed to revamp the lakefront area with more recreation offerings, entertainment opportunities, businesses, and new marina standards. McElyea still thinks the pair would fit in nicely. In front of the beach house would be so neat, she said. Not in the water, but around it. That area has a history, too. Nip and Tuck are safe for now, but their future remains murky. It's unclear whether they will ever return to public display or use. Clevenger said the park district researched the cost of repair, and while no estimates have been received in recent years, the cost is expected to be expensive. Another important factor the park district would have to consider before returning the dolphins back to the community is safety. Exposed wire and jagged concrete edges present just a few of the concerns. Clevenger questioned whether the statues could meet today's requirement for children's play equipment. The rules from 1970 to 80 were vastly different than the rules today, he said. Although many remember the dolphins fondly, they are not considered historical pieces, Clevenger said. You have to have it in an extended time period, he said. But he acknowledged that the statues maintain a special place in the hearts of many community members. From a sentimental value, he said, and for certain people who were attached to them emotionally, then there is value to them. Contact Donette Beckett at 217-421-6983. Follow her on Twitter, at DonetteBHR. Farm Bill Legislation. Farmers await final details. Davis says finalized bill could be confirmed this week by Kevin Barlow. The new farm bill should be finalized any day now, and Central Illinois farmers are ready to see what, if any, changes are in store. U.S. Representative Rodney Davis, Republican of Taylorville, said the deal is the top priority for lawmakers and could be completed this week. "I think it will be a good bipartisan deal," Davis said, as he and other lawmakers returned to Washington this week. The current farm bill officially expired in September, but crop bills are based upon the crop year and not the federal fiscal year, which ended September 30th. All programs in place from the current farm bill will remain in place until a new one is signed. Both the Senate and the House have put forward draft farm bills, and key leaders report the two sides appear to have reached an agreement on most issues. However, federal forest management policies have emerged as the latest snag in the talk, including safeguards needed to limit logging on public lands that could destroy forest habitats and reduce protections for endangered wildlife. The Farm Bill is the primary agricultural and food policy tool of the federal government. The bill is renewed every 5 years, and in addition to agriculture, also supports the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, program, which is federally funded. Davis said he believes leaders are near a final draft, and agreements for most of the major items, such as the SNAP program, are in place. "There's a desire to get it done before it gets shoved into a continuing resolution status," said Adam Nielsen, Director of National Legislation for the Illinois Farm Bureau. "The government shutdown issue will come to a head at the end of next week, so that's the timetable they're looking at. The desire is to get it done before it gets consumed by the appropriations battle." In September, lawmakers approved a temporary funding bill to keep all of the government funded through at least December 7th. Lawmakers would like to approve the farm bill prior to that deadline. Agriculture producers will breathe a sigh of relief once the bill is signed, sealed, and delivered, said Mike Stacy, president of the Macon County Farm Bureau, who farms in western Macon County. "Most farmers are anxious to get it done, so we know where we stand and what's in it," he said. "Farmers should be concerned because it does affect us. There are items such as waterways, and so different farmers are concerned about different things. But we feel good about what we have heard so far." Stacy said he has heard of no major changes of the current programs. "Realistically, we haven't received much payment from the farm programs, and I think most farmers are happy that we don't have to rely on the government for those," he said. "We would rather get our profits or losses from the market itself." One exception is that President Donald Trump's administration is pressuring Congress to include provisions in the Farm Policy Bill that would roll back regulations on forest thinning projects, a move the administration says would save lives and property. Most experts say there is not much difference between the current draft and the standing Farm Bill, which at the time was viewed as a victory for Central Illinois farmers. "I would say that I am about 80% to 90% confident that we're going to get this bill done and have it something we can work with," said Rodney Wienzier, executive director of the Bloomington-based Illinois Corn Growers Association. "The biggest issue is the time element, and it looks like the last issue is the forest management issue. The safety net for farmers is agreeable, and the conservation and SNAP programs seem to have agreements. I think there are just a final few holdups with the forest management issue, and then we can have something to read." Clinton Nuclear Plant, inspectors keeping a watchful eye. "Meet the people who ensure all stays safe at facility," by Kevin Barlow, Clinton. Elba Sanchez Santiago worries about some things at her job that others might see as insignificant, but her immense responsibilities require attention to the most minute details. Once, she found a screw had fallen on a piece of equipment at the Clinton Power Station, a sprawling facility that can power up to 1 million homes through a boiling water reactor. Discounting the number of improbable circumstances that might warrant use of an emergency diesel backup generator, she ordered Exelon employees to find out where the screw was supposed to be, correct it, and tell her why it came loose. It is all part of her job as one of the two Nuclear Regulatory Commission resident inspectors at the plant. We make sure of every little thing, no matter how significant it might appear to be, said Dan Sargis, the other plant inspector, during a tour. The inspectors are a key piece of the safety net to make sure the nation's 98 nuclear power reactors are properly functioning. The Clinton plant, recognizable by a pale blue domed roof, opened in 1987 and is cooled by the man-made Clinton Lake. There also are reactors in Byron, Morris, Marseilles, and North Cordova, Illinois. Emergency diesel generators are a backup source of emergency power in nuclear power plants in case the plant loses its power supply. The one at the Clinton plant is regularly tested but has never been put into actual use. Sanchez, Santiago, and Sargis tour the plant regularly, looking for anything that could lead to an unsafe situation. They're employed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and even when they aren't at the plant, remain on call in case of emergency. They are the agency's eyes and ears, said Victoria Mittling, a senior public affairs officer with the NRC. Inspectors meet with plant management to discuss safety issues, and as part of their routine, walk through the plant to inspect equipment, facilities, and operations. While both Sanchez Santiago and Sargis have engaging personalities, few people at the plant know much about them. We are independent and can't even socialize with plant employees, said Sanchez Santiago. We're required to maintain objective, and in order to do that, we can't be friends with anyone on site. We come in with that premise, and it is required. They can't participate in Exelon activities or fundraisers. As an added precaution, inspectors are rotated out of their locations after serving 7 years. The NRC launched the inspector program in 1978 to improve the agency's oversight by being able to independently verify the performance of plant operators and equipment. Just like everyone else, the inspectors pass through security checkpoints. Their daily routine includes a visit to the plant's main control room to get information on the plant's status from the operators. We oversee absolutely everything and have access to all of Exelon's information, including all of the documents for the operation of the plant, Sargis said. Resident inspectors also observe during emergency exercises. In the case of something unusual, inspectors are the first point of contact for Exelon officials. If there's some type of emergency or unusual activity, we would go to the Technical Support Center and assist with dealing with it, Sargis said. We would be in contact with our regional office and just make sure that everything is being done so that the public is safe. Plant workers can bring their concerns about plant management or potential issues to the inspectors or submit them anonymously. Additionally, they are always undergoing training or education on new issues. In the case of an event, we have to be the most knowledgeable and need to know where to find information quickly, Sanchez Santiago said. You have to know what to expect in any kind of situation. Employed by the NRC, a first-year inspector can expect to start at a salary between $55,000 and $60,000. No 2 days are the same, Sanchez Santiago said. But the public health and safety of the community is so important, and these positions are important. You have to know everything and know who to call when you don't know. Contact Kevin Barlow at 309-820-3238. Follow him on Twitter at pg.barlow, City to Set Tax Levy, by Tom Lisi, Decatur. Officials are expecting the value of taxable property in Decatur to decline for the second year in a row. Another troublesome sign for a city government that is struggling to maintain services in the face of stagnant tax revenue. The county assessor's office started out estimating a 1% decline in city property values because of trending factors like recent home sales, city treasurer Greg Ziantara said during a budget presentation Wednesday that was open to the public. But after more property owners successfully challenged the assessed values of their homes and buildings, city officials expect the decline will be greater when the assessor's office comes up with a final number in February, according to Ziantara. Every year, the supervisor of assessment's office estimates how much each and every property in Macon County is worth. And after a slight recovery in the city's assessed property values in 2016 and 2017, that trend has reversed. The City Council is expected to vote on the city's 2019 property tax levy next month, and staff has proposed $13,877,000, about $10 more than what the city received in 2018. While it's difficult to say how an individual property owner's tax bill will be affected, less property value means the city's rate will go up. The tax rate will go up, but dollars to be raised is essentially unchanged, Ziantara said. The city's property tax levy accounts for just a share of property tax bills for Decatur residents, about 16%. But declining property values mean it will take a higher tax rate to collect the same amount of money. The city's property tax also represents a relatively small portion of the $194 million of revenue officials expect to receive in 2019 through other taxes, fees, fines, and funding from federal and state governments. Property tax receipts pay primarily for the city's contribution to the pension funds for police and fire department employees, the Decatur Public Library, and debt service. Interim City Manager Billy Tyus said one reason for the declining property value in Decatur is because county data of recent home sales show declining property values there, but that it may not reflect the most recent sales. That data lags between when it gets back into values. So if we in the past had the number of sales and sales value goes down, the city's total taxable property value catches up to it, Tyus said. City officials also pointed to old housing stock and the increasing number of exemptions homeowners can claim under state law. But the declines appear to be most pronounced in the city. From 2013 to this year, taxable property value in all of Macon County increased by more than $30 million. In the same time period, the city of Decatur lost $30 million in taxable property value, according to county data. The struggle to keep the city's funding levels extends to other parts of the city budget as well. Tyus has called the proposed city budget for next year a bridge that gives officials time to consider what changes must be made to find ways to either cut costs or raise more revenue. This budget is not a permanent fix, Tyus said, but it allows the city to go forward on various infrastructure projects and maintain services while staff and the council come up with solutions. 2019 budget proposal at a glance. Total city budget, $219 million. General operations fund, $68 million. City's property tax levy, $13.8 million. Total funds for neighborhood improvement work, $2.9 million. Amount for scheduled infrastructure projects, $28 million. Normal man sentenced for killing two dogs by Edith Brady Lunney, Bloomington. A normal man has been sentenced to 24 months conditional discharge for aggravated animal cruelty in the deaths of two dogs a year ago. Gary J. Eustace was charged in December 2017 with killing two dogs by enclosing them in a garage while a vehicle was running. A charge of littering for dumping the dead animals along Twin Grove Road, west of Bloomington, was dismissed in September. Police became involved when a witness took a photo of a vehicle as it sped away after the driver dumped the bodies of the animals. Eustace, 72, pleaded guilty Tuesday to two counts of aggravated cruelty to animals, a Class 4 felony. Two counts accusing him of euthanizing companion animals were dismissed. Conditional discharge is a non-reporting probation in which the conduct of the defendant is reviewed at the end of the period to see that the requirements have been met. In a statement to Judge Casey Costigan at his sentencing hearing, Eustace apologized for his decision to kill the animals that he said were left with his family. Eustace said his actions were not taken with malice, a fit of anger, or for sport. Instead, Eustace said, he wanted to save the cost of having the dogs legally euthanized by a vet, according to his statement. The defendant said he was clueless that his actions were criminal. The judge acknowledged Eustace's long history of dog ownership, including his volunteer work with taking therapy dogs to nursing homes. He also noted reports of the advanced age and aggressive nature of the dogs. The sentence of conditional discharge and 200 hours of community service with an organization that helps animals was necessary to deter others from harming animals, said the judge. Contact Edith Brady Lunny at 309-820-3276. Follow her on Twitter at PG_Bluny, B-L-U-N-N-Y. Christmas Trees Stolen from Salvation Army by Tony Reed. Decatur. In a case befitting Mr. Grinch, the police are investigating the theft of two artificial Christmas trees, one of them fully decorated and wrapped in lights, from the Decatur Salvation Army headquarters. Salvation Army Major Greg Voller said the decorated 9-foot tree was one of a dozen recently set up to add some festive cheer to the community room of the headquarters at 229 West Main Street. He said the tree was stolen Monday afternoon by a thief bold enough to unplug and carry it out of the building. "Having a Christmas tree stolen from the Salvation Army is a first for me," said Voller, 62. "And the weird thing is, they were able to haul out a big tree that is decorated without anything apparently falling off. There was no trail of broken ornaments or of the lights falling off. It's very strange." The second tree was new and still in its box and was due to be set up in the headquarters foyer, where it was stolen from November 20th. "We know it was that day because we went out to the community meal, Thanksgiving luncheon at the Decatur Civic Center, and when we came back, it was gone," Voller said. He said the two trees together were valued at about $240. "We bought them because we're just trying to be festive and jolly," said Voller. He said the decorations add some seasonal cheer for the homeless who spend nights in the headquarters shelter and are served dinner and breakfast. Decatur police are investigating the thefts, Detective Sergeant Chris Copeland said. Oriana sex abuser gets prison term. By Tony Reed, Decatur. An Oriana man prosecutors described as a sexual predator who befriended children before assaulting them was sentenced to 5 years in prison Wednesday. Brian A. Thompson, 49, was convicted of 3 counts of aggravated criminal sexual assault after a 3-day bench trial in Macon County Circuit Court in July. He was also convicted of 1 count of solicitation to meet a child, and Judge Jeffrey Geisler sentenced him to an additional 3 years on that charge, but ordered the sentence to run concurrently with the 5-year sentence. Assistant State's Attorney Kate Kurtz argued for a long sentence to shield children from Thompson, who has preyed on teenage and preteen girls who lived in his neighborhood. Kurtz said an offender evaluation report on Thompson had shown him to be unrepentant with a high risk of offending again. Public defender Thomas Wheeler argued for a non-custodial sentence that would allow Thompson an opportunity to get psychological counseling and treatment. Wheeler also suggested, as he had in the bench trial, that Thompson had not been entirely to blame and that some of the children involved had been very forward in their behavior. Geisler told Thompson he needed to go to prison to protect the public. Thompson was also ordered to register as a sexual predator for life, submit to medical testing for sexually transmitted diseases, pay fines totaling $700, and repay taxpayers $700 for the sex offender evaluation. He was further ordered to have no contact of any kind with the victims involved. Contact Tony Reed at 217-421-7977. Follow him on Twitter at Tony J. Reed, R-E-I-D. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Herald and Review for Thursday, November 29th, 2018. Please stay tuned.